Hello, Marco Werman here with a quick word. January is just around the corner, which means time is running out to donate to our fundraiser before December 31st. If you've already donated, thank you. You are making it possible for us to bring the world to you every day, for us to cover the people at the center of what we think are the most important stories, and for us to follow the ripple effects of these stories and understand how one global event leads to another. If you haven't donated yet, now is the time. We need you. Your donation won't just support our newsroom, it's also a vote of confidence for this kind of coverage. And you're helping to pay it forward for other listeners just like you who may not be in a position to give right now. Please donate today, support our nonprofit newsroom, and help fund all the stories we want to bring you in 2023. Visit theworld.org/give to donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks, and now the show. With zero COVID a thing of the past, China opens up travel again, leading the U.S. and other countries to impose restrictions on arrivals. And in Taiwan, young men will be required to do a full year of military service. Speaking honestly, some of them are not happy about it.
It sucks. It really sucks.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the South African siblings taking TikTok by storm.
My name is Biko and I'm Mana. And together we are Biko's Mana.
Plus, their show's stealing little brother Mufundo. And we remember the soccer legend who only needed one name, Pele.
His ability and his speed, his strength, was there's so many moves that I even dream with them today.
A legend on the pitch leaves us. All that and more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We begin today with some sad news to report. Edison Arantes do Nascimento, known around the world simply as Pelé, the king of soccer, has died at the age of 82. In recent weeks, Pelé had watched the 2022 World Cup from the hospital where he was dealing with complications from colon cancer. Reporter Michael Fox looks back at the life and the legend of the man who for decades has been synonymous with the beautiful game.
Only the best soccer in the world could produce the greatest player of all time, Pelé. This is how an old black and white film reel narrated in Portuguese begins about Pelé's career. It shows images of Pelé on the field, weaving past opponents, scoring, jumping into the air, the fans cheering. During his two-decade-long professional career, Pelé scored nearly 1,300 goals in just over that many games, a world record. He led his team Santos to two world championships and helped Brazil to win the World Cup three times between 1958 and 1970. That's unprecedented. Last year, well-known Brazilian sports journalist Juca Fauri called him unequivocally the greatest soccer player of all time. There is no question, he said in an interview with the Brazilian outlet Opera Mundi. Pelé was a force of nature, and we will never see something like him again. Generations of Brazilians would agree. Pelé's cleats first touched the pitch for his club team Santos in 1956. He was a 15-year-old rising star. Brazilian soccer has never been the same. Today, Willer Gomes is a Brazilian construction worker who lives in the United States. But like most Brazilian boys, he grew up playing soccer.
Mas o Pelé é algo histórico pra gente, porque ganhou tudo.
Pelé is a legend, he says. He won it all. To us, he's our beacon in the world. Pelé grew up poor in the Brazilian state of Sao Paulo. His father, himself a professional soccer player, taught him to play the sport. In an interview a decade ago, Pelé said he remembered his father crying when Brazil lost the 1950 World Cup finals in Rio de Janeiro. At the time, Pelé was only nine, but he said he promised his father that when he grew up, he would win it for Brazil. He did, 8 years later. That was the Pelé that I watched and learned from when I played youth soccer in Virginia in the 1980s. I remember during soccer camp, we'd break for a few hours in the afternoon and study old black and white tapes of Pelé.
Now Pelé. Oh, and you can see the panic Pelé can cause in the defense there.
Stuff like this 1966 game between Brazil and Portugal, where Pelé, as always, was front and center. Pelé played 19 seasons with his club Santos and competed in four World Cups. But he wasn't just a Brazilian hero. He also transformed soccer in the United States. In 1975, he came out of semi-retirement to join the New York Cosmos. Jorge Siega is a Brazilian who played with Pelé on the Cosmos.
Pelé was amazing that his ability and his speed, his strength was, there's so many moves that I even dream with them today.
Pelé's move to the United States was a huge win for U.S. soccer. Siega says attendance at games skyrocketed after Pelé's arrival. The Cosmos went from only a few thousand spectators to sold-out crowds.
When Pelé came over, all of a sudden, a full house, any place that we went, was always packed. You know, Pelé didn't conquer only the World Cup, whatever he played. He conquered the United States.
Soccer in the U.S. began to take off. By the time I started playing in the early 1980s, there were youth soccer leagues across the country.
Pelé indeed was such an amazing player, right? It was such a unique athlete. But also, I think we need to think of the context, right? It's the man in the historical context.
Rafael Yoris is a Brazilian Latin American history professor at the University of Denver.
He was happening when soccer was becoming an international, the most important international sport globally. Someone who managed well his career, went to the U.S. in the right timing. But I think the world was more open to have someone to be a star in such an important sport that was becoming internationalized. But as you know, as a black man, as a third world figure that could represent a different kind of image in that sport.
In 2000, the international soccer governing body FIFA named Pelé the player of the century alongside Argentina's Diego Maradona. Books have been written about him. Movies have been made, and he is the inspiration for many of the top soccer stars today in Brazil and around the world. Pelé will not be forgotten. For the World, I'm Michael Fox.
As China begins to ease its COVID restrictions, many countries are looking to impose mandatory testing for people traveling from China. In Italy this week, about half of the passengers flying in from China tested positive for COVID-19. So the Italian government is now calling on European Union nations to adopt a common policy for arrivals from China. Here in the U.S., the Biden administration says that starting January 5th, people arriving at U.S. airports from China will need to show a negative COVID test. India, Japan, and South Korea are introducing testing requirements as well for Chinese travelers. Isaac Stonefish is the CEO and founder of Strategy Risks, a China-focused risk firm. He joins us from New York. Isaac, the Chinese government is moving away from its zero COVID policy. It's dropping mandatory quarantine for international arrivals starting next week, for example. How much of an about-face is all this for China?
It's head-spinning. Just a few months ago, frankly, weeks ago, it was a different world, and they've decided to reverse several years of very, I want to say carefully planned policy, but very firmly executed policy.
I mean, the news as we sift through it about COVID-19 inside China is not good, with a big spike in cases and hospitalizations. How bad do you think this could be for people in China?
It's tough to say because we will never get accurate data about COVID infections and COVID deaths in China, in part because the Chinese government classifies deaths from COVID a lot more narrowly than most other countries do, and in part because of the lies, damn lies, Chinese statistics type attitude that the Communist Party takes to its own data. I think for a lot of people, it's a mixed blessing. They were under the most draconian lockdown of probably the world. And on the one hand, you have spiking cases and spiking deaths. On the other hand, you have people's ability to breathe a lot freer than they could even months ago.
How surprised are you that the Biden administration has said it will require a negative test from anyone arriving in the U.S. from China?
Frankly, I am surprised. I think we have to understand that we're locked in a global battle against the Chinese Communist Party, not against the people of China. And every time you place restrictions on a country's citizens, you do risk fanning the flames of xenophobia. And I think there's a lot smarter ways for the Biden administration to want to restrict travel from China and restrict investment from China. They can take other tacks that don't allow people to see this as discriminatory.
What kind of strategies are you thinking of?
Could focus on Chinese Communist Party members, members of the secretive ministry, the United Front, members of China's military, the People's Liberation Army, to make it clear that this is about party members and this is about folks who are responsible, as opposed to just having it broadly against people in China. I think the second piece, too, is the world does need to learn how to live with the virus, and putting up walls again, especially under a democratic administration, sends the wrong message.
So in the first months of the pandemic, as you remember, there was a rush by many countries to establish travel restrictions, followed by a move away from travel restrictions. So how concerned are you, Isaac, that these new rules for arrivals from China, that it's driven by fear, even nationalism or anti-Chinese attitudes, and not based on science?
I think it's driven by all three. I think for so much of the conversation around the pandemic, we conflated science and policy and science and ethics and science and regulations. And so I think it's a question of what is America's risk tolerance? What is our general tolerance, frankly speaking? And then how does that interfere with electoral politics and the optics of these issues?
Isaac Stonefish is CEO and founder of Strategy Risks, a Chinese-focused risk firm. He joined us from New York to talk about new COVID restrictions being placed on travelers from China across the globe. Isaac, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Great to chat, Marco. Thank you.
Here's some unexpected year-end news. We began 2022 in the U.S. with frustration about microchip shortages, to ending the year having more microchips than needed. Right now, semiconductor manufacturers are cutting back on production as demand for microchips plummets. To understand how this happened, we turn to Sujai Shivakumar. He's a senior fellow and director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and joins us from Washington. So how did the U.S. go from a shortage and something of a panic around microchips to what's now considered a glut?
So it's basically an issue of supply and demand. Supply in terms of inventories are up, and demand is down because consumers have stocked up. There was a high demand earlier during the pandemic because people were buying more devices, you know, laptops and other devices during the pandemic as a way of keeping connected with their work and so forth. Another aspect is that, you know, there was a lot of disruption in supply chains during the height of the pandemic, and a lot of those have been resolved. And so the supply has picked up again.
So if we track it back, there were fears of invasion of Taiwan by China that kind of created the panic around microchip supplies. Can you tell us why that was?
The Chinese have long had ambitions of reuniting Taiwan with the mainland. So this area continues to be, you know, geopolitically somewhat sensitive. You know, moreover, I think the pandemic created a realization of the need to make our value chains more robust. And to avoid single points of failure, as you know, around 90% of advanced chips are made in Taiwan. Never mind the geopolitical danger. If there are an earthquake in the region, for example, that could really severely disrupt the supply of advanced semiconductors around the world. So for a variety of reasons, the strategic environment around chips, we have woken up to that. And so there are a number of activities, policies, strategies by the U.S. government to try to minimize that vulnerability.
Right. I mean, the U.S. ramped up production of microchips. Now there's a glut. So would you say the U.S. is now more strategically in control of microchip technology?
Well, I think the microchip factories that are envisioned in the Chips and Science Act, they are still being built. But our strategy is now to focus much more on what's called friendshoring, which is to strengthen networks amongst our allies and strategic partners as well. So the way in which the network of activity supporting this industry globally is in a period of transition right now.
I just bought a space heater the other day. It's got a remote and a memory and microchips. I mean, it's hard to think of a gadget short of a vegetable peeler that doesn't have microchips. I'm, of course, exaggerating. But what does the omnipresence of microchips around the globe mean for the predictability of the whole supply chain?
Well, I think that's the issue why, you know, we are now trying to rewire the supply chains to become much more resilient. These have become so ubiquitous that we depend on them, and a disruption can have, you know, serious implications and repercussions across our economy. It's not just your toaster, but the lack of, you know, chips for your Ford pickup then affects the construction industry and so on and so forth. And given that chips are now, you know, the platform on which our economy runs, it becomes a strategic issue to make sure that the supply of chips remain as robust as possible.
Sujai Shivakumar is a senior fellow and director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with us from Washington. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, three siblings in South Africa making music that is pure joy. We hang out with the kids just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The year is 1498. A strange sickness has come to Aberdeen, then a tiny town in northeast Scotland. It's the plague, and it's deadly. A young local councillor decides he must figure out how to prevent this virus from spreading further and taking more lives, but that means he'll need to persuade the local governors to adopt his strategies. These details are the premise for a new video game, details based on Aberdeen's actual medieval records about what happened in 1498, because the game was designed by historians. William Hepburn is at the University of Aberdeen. He was the creative lead on the video game, which is called Strange Sickness. The first thing that came to my mind, William, with the plot of this video game was, wow, right on brand with the pandemic we've all been living through for 3 years now. How much did COVID influence your choice of subject matter?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It was kind of a grim coincidence, really. So I made a little prototype based on the same story before the pandemic, and that was coincidental. That was about the plague. This just happened to be one of the episodes from the historical sources we were using that seemed, you know, very striking and something that would be interesting for people. So I made a short game on that. And then when COVID came around, suddenly there was a new relevance to it, and that sort of spurred us on to making the sort of more fully fleshed out game that we have now. Some really striking things kind of from what we were experiencing at that time, you know, that you could see in the records. There were some really striking similarities with what people had faced, you know, 500 years ago, albeit the plague was a much more deadly disease than COVID. But some of the measures that were taken to kind of try to defend themselves from the disease were very similar.
So in your game, the young town councillor, whose name is Robert Collinson, he has to come up with a strategy to keep the plague at bay. What are his options?
This is where the similarities with our own experience of the last few years comes in. So there was the options to do things like confine people to their houses who were suspected of having the disease, or build plague houses, essentially, you know, kind of hospitals outside of town where people could be housed while they were recovering from the plague. There was the option to burn the goods of merchants that were suspected of being infected with the disease. And there was a lot of kind of social things like encouraging people to be open about having the disease and so on, and not kind of hide if they had it and things. So we tried to make all of this the driving narrative. A lot of the game is really about these social kind of interactions within the town and who would be upset by these things. And so the merchants would be upset if they had to burn their goods, which is kind of not unlike people in, you know, retail industries and so on being upset during the pandemic that they were going to lose money. So a lot of it was kind of centered around that kind of choice and who would be affected by those choices.
What's really unique about Strange Sickness is how it's based in fact and not fantasy. So how did historical records and your research into those records in Aberdeen help kind of lead you to the creation of this video game?
So Aberdeen has one of the best collections of civic records from the late medieval period anywhere in the UK, to the extent that it's recognised by UNESCO,
right?
Because nowhere else in Scotland has anything like that. So we wanted to find ways of sort of bringing them to new audience, because we think they're a really rich cultural resource. And I just happen to be interested in games and possibilities of games. And I think, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years, the scope of subjects that video games cover has really widened and become a lot more interesting in that regard. So we just thought, can we do something like this? So then gradually built up through various conversations and sort of mini projects to doing a full-on kind of crowdfunding project to try and make this game. And that's kind of how we got there and would like to continue on with. And I think it's opened up a whole load of possibilities, I think, of what we'd like to do next.
William Hepburn is a historian at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland and the creative lead for the Strange Sickness video game. William, thanks so much. Thanks for your time.
Well, thanks very much.
Sweet dreams are made of this, the Eurythmics classic. Recently, Annie Lennox herself tweeted out this cover. "You're going to love these gorgeous and massively talented young peeps," she wrote.
Sweet dreams made of this.
These are are two siblings in South Africa who do their thing on social media. Biko Star, age 15, on lead vocals, and her brother Manahiro, age 13, on guitar and backup vocals. TikTok is where I came upon them recently, and yes, Ms. Lennox heard what I also heard. They are massively talented. The raw videos are refreshingly mesmerizing. Two kids with serious chops, just having fun at home. No fancy sets or costumes. Here's another cover they posted recently, just before turning out the lights and going to bed. They wanted to challenge themselves by taking on a riff from the Gnarls Barkley tune, Crazy.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that play. Even your emotions have an echo in so much space.
Yeah, well, I guess you met the challenge, didn't you? I have with me on the line from Johannesburg the artist you just heard from, Biko Star on vocals, and her brother Manahiro on guitar. I have to ask you first, Biko Star, did you go to bed? Like, did your parents tell you, okay, you tracked it, now go to sleep?
Yeah. It was actually late at night, and we were watching TikTok singing compilations. And then we just bumped into this riff challenge, me and my brother.
My brother was dancing, and
there is one other presence in these TikTok videos, the sibling's little brother, Mufundo, age 8. He pulls up the rear in the ensemble, you could say. While Biko and Mana are singing and strumming, Mufundo dances and grooves to the music in the background, maybe wearing a scuba mask or walking like an Egyptian to the music. He actually kind of steals a show from the enormously talented musicians in the foreground. Not easy to do. A few years ago, when Biko and Mana began busking in the streets of their hometown in South Africa, Maboneng, Mufundo couldn't help himself. He had to be with them, doing something.
During our performances, when we mentioned our group name, we would say, my name is Biko and I'm Mana, and together we are Biko's Mana. And then he would just say, Mufundo, in the background. So he's just that child who doesn't want to be left out.
Yeah.
And Mufundo, the young one in any three sibling combo, can relate to not wanting to be left out. The act is definitely not the same without him. Speaking with Biko, Mana, and Mufundo, you get that hit of irrepressible kid energy that made me believe anything is possible. The whole scene is enchanting, as many have discovered, like Annie Lennox and other influential listeners.
Thank you so much. You guys have supported us at an overwhelming rate to the point where Mrs. Jada Pinkett Smith, Madison Ryan, Chloe Bailey, Sean King, and the Timberland saw our video. Oh my gosh, we are so grateful and humbled.
So you shout out there to Jada Pinkett Smith, Timberland, who apparently have watched your videos. What did that mean to you?
Oh my gosh, it means a lot. It really inspired us to actually be disciplined and be consistent on rehearsing every day. It gives us hope for the future that our music is one day going to blow out.
It seems to be happening for Biko, Mana, Mufundo right now. The kids are homeschooled, which gives them a flexible rehearsal schedule. Their parents, also musicians, support them. Here's one other cover for some holiday cheer, Biko, Mana, and Mufundo's version of My Favorite Things.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, my coop with cattles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with
strings. Biko, Mana, and Mufundo, now one of My Favorite Things. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Canary Islands, famous for their stunning beaches, and increasingly the Spanish territory is a destination for African migrants.
Más de 400 embarcaciones han desaparecido los últimos 5 años.
In recent years, this activist says, the Canaries have seen hundreds of boats bringing in more than 10,000 people on what's considered a dangerous voyage. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. As 2022 comes to a close, something we've been thinking about on the show are not just the crises around the globe, but also stories of people who help out others during hard times. People who take in strangers displaced by war, or those of you who deliver food when a neighbor is sick.
Showing up for family members in crisis would seem like the natural thing to do, but sometimes that can be complicated. This next story takes us to Argentina and one woman who struggled to figure out whom to put first, herself or her father.
Hello, my name is Cayetana Vidal and I'm from Buenos Aires, Argentina. And right now I'm in Tomo Uno restaurant. For me, being in a kitchen is being with my dad. You know, every time I taste a wine, I kind of remember what he liked. Every time I have a wonderful meal, I just imagine, you know, what he would have said and, you know, being there, sitting with us. My first memory going out for dinner with my dad was going to a very fancy restaurant called Lola in the very fancy neighborhood of Recoleta in Buenos Aires. It was very elegant with like white tablecloth, very shiny silverware, and all these waiters very well dressed. I was 10 years old and I was very excited, you know, to go to that place. We went there with my brother and sister, which we were all very excited. Everybody was, you know, saying hello to my dad, and we felt like there was a very special treatment. You know, I remember feeling very proud of my dad. He pushed us to try everything, right? He was like, okay, I'm gonna order, you know, this endive with, you know, Parmesan cheese, this liver pate. My brother and sister were more reluctant to try things, but I always liked to try everything. It seemed like an adventure. I remember that there was a dish in the list that was a milanesa, which is a very common dish here in Argentina. It's a cutlet. It's just breaded meat, fried. You know, the presentation was amazing and everything. And so I cut this milanesa very slowly. And my dad was asking, you know, how is it? What do you think? And I said, I think it's fried in olive oil instead of corn oil, which is what we normally use here. He called the chef and he asked, did you fry this in olive oil? And the guy was, yes. Indeed, it was. And so my dad was like, oh, in awe. I couldn't believe that I figured that out. Normally, 10 years old don't even know what olive oil really is or that there are different kind of oils at all. I guess at that moment, he decided that I would be his heir, you know, that I would be the one doing the same thing he was doing, which is being a food critic. My father's name is Fernando Vidal Bussi.
Muy bien, Fernando, ¿cómo estás?
Vos sos una figura emblemática.
He's kind of a pioneer in Argentina.
¿Qué nos preparó esta vez, Fernando?
Vamos a probar un vino blanco que es.
He had a TV show at some point about wines and then another one about restaurants.
¿Con un tenedor? No, yo lo veo.
Un cuadradito de pan.
So people would recognize him in the street, people asking for autographs, I don't know. And his critiques also were very respected by restaurants. They were all hoping to have my dad go eat to have their critiques in the magazine. So I guess he was kind of a celebrity in his field. During my childhood, I was always very close to my father. My mother was ill since I was little. She had depression, so she was going in and out psychiatric institutions. My dad, we were friends. We laughed about the same things. We were exactly the same person somehow, you know, like it was, we had the same personality and tastes and he was my parent, basically, the parent I trusted. My mom, you know, wasn't really there, and he always was there for me. He would take me to school, and we would go out for dinner. These outings with my dad were completely intoxicating. It was like traveling, you know, like going to another world. Growing up, being a teenager, I started having some more distance with my dad. He really wanted to push me onto writing about food. I just wanted to leave and start my own life. I wanted to go to film school, you know, follow my passion. My dad was like, I don't think you're going to make a career on film. Until one day I said, I'm done with this. I applied to film school in New York. I got accepted. I'm leaving. He got so worried. You know, I was making a mistake. But I moved to New York, went to NYU to do an MFA on film for 3 years. When I was leaving the U.S., I didn't talk to my dad too often. He would write me very long, melancholic emails.
Hijita del alma.
Like it was a monologue from him.
Tuve que imprimirla y leerla varias veces. Tu visión fue muy precisa.
So we grew apart a lot. Also, it was interesting because living in New York, I started trying all these other types of food that I couldn't eat in Argentina that I didn't know about, like Asian food, Thai, Japanese. I remember telling him he didn't like that I knew more foods than he knew, you know, like, hold on, you know, I'm the authority here. And then later on, when he was much older, when I came back from the United States, my dad had just divorced from his third marriage. He was 72 years old. He was living on his own, which he had never did. You know, he was always married, always surrounded by people. So when I arrived, he was very depressed and he didn't have any savings. So I started paying, you know, a little bit of a close attention of what he was doing work-wise. That's when he actually sat with me again. He was like, you need to keep going with what I'm doing. He was very forward about it. And I really didn't feel at all like I wanted to do it. Suddenly, one day, you know, this particular restaurant calls very angry because basically my dad had written about a restaurant that was completely different. He totally messed up, you know, restaurants in his head. He would just write things that didn't make any sense at all. I can totally sense that something was wrong with him. He had a dementia that was advancing very quickly. I could tell that this was getting worse every day. We needed to take action on this. So at the beginning, I started going to these restaurants with him, and then I would take over and write the article, and he would sign it. So that's how I became my dad's ghostwriter. Before all, I had to protect being anonymous, right? Like, I was trying to imitate what he was doing. So that felt like going back to school, right? Like, I was back to, you know, doing my homework to support the family. And that wasn't nice. So I remember that it made me very, very nervous. Like, I was screwing up every article and did a lot of research. And I thank God there was internet at this time, right? Like, already, so that I could Google a lot of it. And, you know, that was a lot of pressure for me because I just felt like I needed to support this character, right? Like, I needed to just hold everything about who he was for people to keep respecting him. But then, of course, this was a progression. My dad, he started almost not eating when he got dementia. He lost a lot of weight. He tasted wine and he would say, ah, this is poison, which was a shocker because my dad loved wine. So I started going myself to the restaurants. Of course, the reservations were, you know, under his name, but I would show up and say, well, he couldn't make it. I'm his daughter. I'll be tasting the meal tonight. I went to Punta del Este, which is this, you know, beach place in Uruguay, to cover this restaurant. And I sit with the owner of the restaurant, and she tells me that she's a film producer, that she lives in Britain, and that she has done this film and this other film. And I was like, I'm a filmmaker. And I was working on this script, and I had brought it with me. And I gave it to her, and, you know, she read it, and she was like, oh, I think this is really interesting material. Let me see if there's something we can do, and we can figure it out, you know. You know, I didn't have my hopes too high, but it was a good opportunity. I wrote a great article about her restaurant. And then back in Buenos Aires, this lady was calling me to tell me that she wanted to take the project, that she wanted to make my film. And she was telling, okay, we'll have Vanessa Paradis be the star, you know, this French actress. And I was like, what's going on? And my dad was the moment of the day that he would go out for a walk. And I was on Skype with this woman, and my dad was like, I need to go, screaming with me. You know, my dad started hitting the door, making a lot of noise. And he was like, what are you doing with that computer? And this woman, you know, was trying to have a very serious conversation about how we were going to make my film. And I finally had to tell her, you know what, I'm having a situation with my dad right now. I really need to hang up and I need to take care of this. And she wasn't happy at all. She wasn't nice about it. Finally hung up and left with my dad, and we went for his walk. Then later on, he was in a hospital, and again, this woman calls me. So again, I have to hang up on this woman. She was like, well, you know what? You need to make a decision. Are you going to take care of your dad, or are you going to make your film? And again, for me, there was no doubt. I was just so, you know, positive that that was my role at that moment, you know, to be there for him. I think my love for my dad was too big. I don't know. I had never any doubts that that was what I had to do. He meant a lot, you know. He meant so much to me, that more than anything else that I could do. Well, the end, I did call the magazine and I said, okay, my dad is going to die soon. I've been doing his job. And that's when they said, we knew all along and we want you to keep doing it with your own signature. So it was a relief, but also a decision. This is serious now. This is now me doing this. Do I want to do it? But then, you know, like 6 years have passed and since my dad died, and I'm still doing it. Squeezed tomato and poached quail egg. The way the tomato is prepared, like it's like concassé. The shrimp chupe, which is a traditional Peruvian plate that my dad loved. Today, I write my restaurant critique every week. Okay, so I'm putting some of that buttery sauce on the tentacles and just tasting it. I think I have my own voice, but I get very mixed up. And kind of like my dad's voice speaks the loudest to me. Sometimes I mistake that voice with my own because we were so similar and we have similar tastes and sense of humor and sensibilities, you know. Together with a tomato. But then sometimes it goes too far, you know, this voice speaks too loud. And I have to just sort of shut that voice down in my head. And I do have a voice of my own that has nothing to do with my dad's voice. And that's kind of the voice that sometimes I have trouble finding. Or hearing.
Cayetana Vidal from Buenos Aires, Argentina, reflecting on life with her dad, Fernando Vidal Bussi. The story was produced by Ari Daniel with music and sound design by Ian Koss. A version of the story premiered during a live show with the Museum of Science, Boston. Brazil's president-elect will not be sworn in until New Year's Day, but Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is already sending signals about how he intends to steer the next government. Today, Lula, as he's known in Brazil, announced the appointment of Marina Silva as environment minister. She's a well-known activist for the Amazon region, and Silva also served as minister for the environment during Lula's previous term from 2003 to 2010. Her appointment will be seen as a commitment from the president-elect that he intends to live up to his promise to stop deforestation in the Amazon. Environmentalists will applaud the choice of Marina Silva, but it's sure to rankle Brazil's muscular agribusiness lobby. Tomorrow on The World, join us for a deeper look at what else we can expect from Lula's new term as president. The Canary Islands of Spain are a tourist destination. They're also becoming a stepping stone for migrants who are desperate to reach Europe from Africa. The Canaries are located in the Atlantic Ocean, some 80 miles off the coast of Morocco, but the passage through those waters can be dangerous, as we hear from Jerry Haddon on the Canary Island of Lanzarote.
When teenager Mohamed Mandia at last climbed into the boat on a beach in the dark last August, he says he put his life in God's hands.
On the 47 person.
There were 47 of us, he says, on a small open boat, about 20 feet long by 8 feet wide. I didn't know anyone. Once at sea, I thought, I can't die out here. Mandia from Senegal was 17 at the time. He'd been on the road for nearly a year before setting sail from Western Sahara.
My mère et mon père n'est pas encore en vie.
My dad and mom had passed away, he says. My brother was in Italy. That's why I left, to earn money. After 3 days at sea, Mandia's boat washed up along Lanzarote's rocky coastline. He ended up in a facility for unaccompanied minors. He spoke no Spanish, had no possessions, no plan, beyond escaping poverty. He was one of the lucky ones, says migrant activist and attorney Luela Mint Almami.
Más de 400 embarcaciones han desaparecido en los últimos 5 años.
In the last 5 years, more than 400 boats have disappeared, she says, along with some 11,000 migrants on the Atlantic crossing. The boats depend on the current, she says, and sometimes they're swept out to sea. And sometimes they're smashed against the sharp volcanic rocks that make up most of Lanzarote's coastline. If you walk around the island, you can spot the boats, called pateras in Spanish, just listing on the rocks. This is an old wooden ship, about 6 meters or 20 feet long. Somebody, who knows how many people, came across probably from the Western Sahara region of Morocco in this, basically looks like an oversized dinghy. It's just got some simple wooden benches in it, and it's just sitting here, rotting away under the hot sun. These boats are symbols of tragedy and danger. 29-year-old Moroccan Boujama Mahbou came on one just like this 10 years ago. His patera made it to within 60 feet of the shore, then it flipped over.
Claro, en ese momento yo sabía nadar. Un poco, pero en ese momento no podía nadar porque estoy...
I knew how to swim a little, he says, but I couldn't even raise my hands because I was so exhausted after the long trip. The water was pulling at my clothes, he says. I couldn't move. Mahbou says in the dark he found a piece of wood and floated until he was rescued. He was one of 8 survivors that night out of the 27 people on his patera. The rest drowned. Despite the dangers, the pateras keep coming. The main reason, says attorney Mint Almami, the safer routes to Europe have been closed, namely crossing the Mediterranean from Morocco's northern coastline to Spain.
Marruecos, con el dinero que le ha dado la Unión Europea, ha blindado la zona norte.
She says Morocco reached a deal with the European Union earlier this year to close that route, Morocco has militarized its northern Mediterranean coast, she says, which is pushing people south to leave from Western Sahara or even from Mauritania or Senegal. Or from further afield. Earlier this month, three Nigerian men survived for 11 days balanced on the rudder of a giant container ship before reaching the Canary Islands. The images were on the news everywhere. Stowing away, smuggled over on pateras, migrants are coming to the Canaries any way they can. In 2020, during the COVID-19 pandemic, when the tourists stopped coming, a record 23,000 migrants arrived, says Lanzarote activist Silverio Campos.
Entonces, durante el COVID, se disminuyó la población que estaba estacional aquí.
During COVID, our seasonal workforce went down, he says, but the pateras kept coming in larger numbers. Yet, obviously, the people weren't coming to work, he says. It defies logic. Except maybe the logic of hunger. COVID devastated the Canary Island economy, but the damage to many African countries was even worse. Campos heads a government-funded halfway house for young migrants once they turn 18. It's called Trib Arte. Here, residents learn basic life skills like cooking, making tea, and cleaning up after themselves. But Tribarte has just 12 beds, not nearly enough for the roughly 100 people released each year from the facility for minors. Mohamed Mandia, the young guy from Senegal, secured a spot here just a couple of weeks ago.
Pour moi seulement, depuis que je venais, je n'ai même pas sais écrire. Mais alors là, je écris bien.
Back home, he says, I couldn't read or write. Now I'm learning Spanish and French. Thanks to these social workers, I'm feeling happy. Mandia says he hopes to find a job in a hotel now that the tourists are back. Campos says he's a shoo-in.
Nos llaman directores de hoteles, empresarios.
Hotel managers and business owners are calling us, he says, asking us if our residents can work. When I tell them they don't have the language skills yet, they say, so what? The Canary Islands and Europe in general are bouncing back from the COVID pandemic, which is likely to lure more desperate migrants from Africa and beyond. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Lanzarote, Spain.
10 men have been convicted in the Dominican Republic for the attempted murder of David Ortiz, the beloved Boston Red Sox Hall of Famer.
Ortiz in the deep right field.
That crack of Big Poppy's bat helped the Red Sox reverse the curse in 2004. Fast forward to 2019, Ortiz is retired, and that's when would-be assassins came for him. It was after nightfall at a sidewalk bar in Santo Domingo. There's footage of the shooting stitched together from different security cameras with no sound. It shows a man stepping up behind Ortiz. He grips a pistol with two hands. The gun kicks, and there's a faint puff of smoke. Ortiz crumples to the ground from his chair as people flee. In the hospital, doctors perform surgery. The Red Sox sent a plane to bring David Ortiz back to Boston, to Massachusetts General Hospital. Ortiz hired a former Boston police commissioner and an ex-CIA official to investigate. They would later claim the hit was ordered by drug lord Cesar the Abuser Emilio Peralta. As the story goes, Peralta was jealous of Big Poppy's fame. Peralta's lawyer says he had nothing to do with the shooting, and he was never charged. In the end, the U.S. government busted Peralta for drug trafficking. David Ortiz says he's forgiven the guys who tried to kill him. Or as he once put it when asked about how he was doing after the shooting.
Thank God, you know, I'm good, I'm healthy, you know, everything is going good. I can, you know, I went back to my normal life and it's all good, man, all gravy.
It's all gravy. That's why he is Big Poppy. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
Compadre Pedro Juan, no pierda el tiempo. Compadre Pedro Juan, saca en su dama. Acabará el merengue si no anda con cuidado. Se quedará como perico atrapado.
Before we go, Marco here with a quick reminder. Time is running out to donate to our fundraiser and help us unlock a $67,000 matching gift. If you've been meaning to donate but haven't yet, we need you to step up now. Your gift will help sustain our newsroom into 2023. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.